All right, we finished First Chronicles last week, just in the sense that we actually gave an introduction to both of the books for a few weeks. So I'd like to turn now to Second Chronicles chapter 2. I'm still giving an introduction because I don't want to take forever on it, and you may think that's what I want to do, but I'm actually planning to start systematically going through the book at chapter 10 with the divided kingdom. In part because that, I think, is less familiar, and the writer of Chronicles adds a lot of information which is not in the books of Samuel and Kings, especially Kings in that case. But I'd still like to give the background, and especially as we've seen, the emphasis in the writer of the Chronicles is on God's worship and building up really to these chapters which we're looking at, the building of the temple, and then later on the analysis or the evaluation of the kings is always in terms of how faithful they were to preserve the worship God had appointed, as well as some other criteria. But I'd like to look, starting at 2 Chronicles chapter 2, we looked last week at the reign, the beginning of the reign of Solomon and the glory that God gave to him, his humility in asking God not for the death of his enemies or riches or anything like that, but for wisdom to govern the great people God had given by promise. And now he turns to the work of building the temple. So 2 Chronicles 2:1, then Solomon determined to build a temple for the name of the Lord and a royal house for himself. So that's a reference to the king's palace, which is actually hardly ever mentioned in Chronicles. But especially the building of the temple then. So Solomon in verse 2 selected 70,000 men to bear burdens, 80,000 to quarry stone in the mountains, and 3,600 to oversee them. Then Solomon sent to Hiram, king of Tyre, saying, "As you have dealt with David, my father, and sent him cedars to build himself a house to dwell in, so deal with me. Behold, I am building a temple for the name of the Lord my God, to get dedicated to him, to burn before him sweet incense, for the continual showbread, for the burnt offerings, morning and evening, on the Sabbaths, on the new moons, and on the set feasts of the Lord our God. This is an ordinance forever to Israel. And the temple which I build will be great, for our God is greater than all gods. But who is able to build him a temple, since heaven and the heaven of heavens cannot contain him? Who am I then that I should build him a temple, except to burn sacrifice before him? Therefore send me at once a man skillful to work in gold and silver, in bronze and iron." That's not in the Bible. "In purple and crimson and blue, who has skill to engrave with the skillful men who are with me in Judah and Jerusalem, whom David my father provided." And he goes on to ask for provision, especially the cedar for which Lebanon was famous for that part of the world. So Solomon first seeks to set about the acquiring of skilled workers. Let me just make a comment that in verse 2, when it says he selected these men to bear burdens, it seems to be the case in Chronicles that the men who were used as slave labor, you might say, were the non-Israelites, those who, for various reasons, were still in the land, whether descendants of those who had been there originally or those who had been captive, brought captive during wars. It's not very clear in this verse, but if you read throughout, there seems to be the emphasis that it's the Israelites who are the overseers and have the administrative responsibilities. They were the managers, and the slave labor, it seems, were those of the other nations. That's not completely clear, and certainly it doesn't come through in this verse, but I thought I would just make that comment here. But I'd like to make a few comments then on chapter 2, because this letter gives you some of the heart of Solomon for the work that he's doing. And then what I'd like to do is to go, so my plan today is just to go through four chapters, 2, 3, 4, and 5, but we'll look at a few references in addition to that. In chapter 2, then, the letter that Solomon writes has some interesting aspects. First of all, you notice the description that's given in verse 4 of some of the worship that will take place there. Burn before him sweet incense, continual showbread, and so forth. Now that's not new. The description here is, of course, what you would have found in the book of Exodus in terms of the worship of God. We saw before that much of the musical addition, the musical instruments and the choirs and so forth were added, but Solomon doesn't mention that here. he merely dwells on some of the aspects which would have gone back to Moses. And the interesting thing is, he says in verse 5, the temple which I build will be great, for our God is greater than all gods. And you can see here some of the excitement that Solomon has, as well as what you might call even an evangelistic kind of thrust. But he's not writing this to a fellow Israelite. He's writing this to Hiram, king of Tyre, which was a pagan nation. Now, Hiram later on has some words of praise for God. So exactly what the state of Hiram's heart is, I'm not going to inquire into. But still, you see that the emphasis here is Solomon is writing, as it were, a letter to, you might say, to the world, and saying, our God is greater than all gods, and the gods of the nations, of course, the Psalms emphasize again and again, are vanity, are emptiness. And so the temple that Solomon will build will reflect the greatness of God. Then in verse 6, he, of course, makes it very plain that consistent with that is the fact that no one could really build a temple for God. And so he says in verse 6, who is able to build him a temple, since heaven and the heaven of heavens cannot contain him? So this is not some pagan notion of God, that God could be contained in an earthly building, or that he was limited somehow. God always made it plain that he dwelt with his people in a special way in the tabernacle and later on in the temple. So in a special sense, his presence was there. But lest they be arrogant, which of course they were later on, and we're tempted to be, we cannot contain God in a building or limit him in any way. He is the one who declares what he will do, and he makes it very plain, for example, in Isaiah, echoing language like this, the heaven and the heaven of heavens cannot contain him. And so the right response to that is the humble response in verse 6, who am I then that I should build the temple? We've seen that kind of rhetorical question already a few times in Chronicles. It's a good rhetorical question for us to ask. Who am I? Who am I that I should have this blessing and privilege from God? David said that when all of the wealth of the nation and the conquered nations was brought in to build God's temple. Who are we that we should be able to contribute to such a great work as this? And so Solomon says here, I'm a hot shot because I have the greatest of all gods, but it's a humbling experience. Who am I that I should build the temple? And he acknowledges that the purpose of it is for worship, except the burn sacrifice before him. So there already is an acknowledgement of their own sinfulness and their need for the sacrifice, the covering of their sins. So those are some of the things which can be drawn out of these verses. There's a lot that can be said about this and about the setup which he sought. Let me just skip down to verses 11 and 12. Then Hiram, king of Tyre, answered in writing, which he sent to Solomon, because the Lord loves his people, he has made you king over them. Hiram also said, blessed be the Lord God of Israel, who made heaven and earth, for he has given King David a wise son, endowed with prudence and understanding, who will build a temple for the Lord and a royal house for himself. And then he goes on to describe the man he's sending. By the way, there's a little confusion here because Hiram is the king of Tyre. He's also called Huron. There's some variation in the way his name is referred to. And his master craftsman in verse 13 is Huron. They're two different people. Okay? But Hiram is the one who writes the letter. And he has this praise for God, really, because the Lord loves his people, he has made you king over them. This is the sort of thing we saw Queen Sheba later on, the Queen of Sheba will later on say about the amazing way that God blessed Solomon. And then in verse 12, Hiram dwells on the greatness of God. But in this, interestingly enough, in this kind of covenantal language that we've been saying, it's the emphasis on the blessing to David, who's given David, who was Hiram's friend. They had had a relationship already before, some sort of alliance or treaty. He's blessing the Lord for the provision for David of a godly son, sitting on the throne. Any comments or questions on just that that bit there that we looked at in chapter 2? Well, I'd like to move on then to look at some of what goes on in chapter 3. And by the way, in verse 17 of chapter 2, while you're turning there, you can see Solomon numbered all the aliens who were in the land of Israel, and he made them bearers of burdens. So that's the sort of verse I was referring to. It seems that the ones who were doing the forced labor were the aliens. Chapter 3, verse 1, we read already, but let me remind you. Now Solomon began to build the house of the Lord at Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where the Lord had appeared to his father David, the place that David had prepared on the threshing floor of Ornan, the Jebusite. And he began to build on the second day of the second month, in the fourth year of his reign. This is the foundation that Solomon laid for the building, the house of God. The length was 60 cubits by cubits according to the former measure, and the width 20 cubits. And then it goes on to describe some of the details of the building. Now, as we already explained, it was last week, verse 1 there, the reference to Mount Moriah is the connection with toward the end of 1 Chronicles, where the plague was on the nation, remember, and God was judging them. And the plague was stopped at this threshing floor of this fellow. And God withheld his hand of judgment, and David said this would be the place for the temple of God, apparently by God's commandment. And so that reference in 3:1 is going back to that, but the use of Moriah connects further back to the offering of Isaac, as we saw before. Now, the details of the building of the temple are given here. There are actually two different lengths of cubits, and there's an allusion to that here by the cubits according to the former measure. I don't think we'll go into detailed discussion of a cubit, but a cubit is about 18 inches long, about a foot and a half long. So if you want to make comparisons, the temple would be about 30 feet by 90 feet in terms of the exterior. Now, of course, there's a lot of detail in terms of the size of the divisions inside, and there are these accompanying rooms built along the outside. For example, the Holy of Holies was built in the shape of a perfect cube. But all of those details, I think, are probably ones that I'm not going to go through too much. I'll make a few comments as we go along. But the basic outline is very similar to what was found in the tabernacle. There are some differences, but the basic shape is very similar. The richness of the building is emphasized. For example, verse 8, there's already been a reference to gold, but notice in verse 8, he made the most holy place. It's referred to as the Holy of Holies in various names. Its length was according to the width of the house, 20 cubits, and its width, 20 cubits. He overlaid it with 600 talents of fine gold. But that's a lot of money. I think if you look back in 1 Chronicles, the amount that David built for the site was 500 talents of gold, and that was included the oxen for the sacrifice and all that. This is a very, you might say, extravagant use of wealth, although it's not too good for God, obviously. The weight of the nails in verse 9 was 50 shekels of gold, and he overlaid the upper area with gold. And they apparently attached this gold to the walls with golden nails. That seems to be the idea here. So there's a very rich description here. And of course, in verses 10 and 11 is the description of the cherubim, which were already present in the tabernacle. And he goes on to describe the setup there. I'm just picking out a few things here. Verse 16, he also made in front of the temple two pillars, 35 cubits high, with the capital that was on the top of each of them. And the capital that was on the top of each of them was 5 cubits. And then there's some further description. In verse 17, he set up the pillars before the temple, one on the right hand and the other on the left. He called the name of the one on the right hand Jacob, and the name of the one on the left Boaz. Both of those have, those names have significance in terms of God really being the strength of the temple blessing to his people. I'd like to come back to look at some of the New Testament references to this, and especially a look at the pillars. But it seems that the pillars weren't actually structural pillars in the sense that they supported the front part of the building. So it may not be completely clear. It seems that they were ornamental type of pillars, and there was certainly a decoration on the top of them. Chapter 4 continues with some of the details of the furnishings of the temple. So in verse 1 of chapter 4, a bronze altar. In verse 2, he made the sea of cast bronze, 10 cubits from one brim to the other. It was completely round. Its height was 5 cubits, and a line of 30 cubits measured its circumference. So this is what you get for having a mathematician teach the class. But this verse is actually referred to in history of mathematics books because it's an example of an ancient approximation of the ratio of, well, the circumference of a circle and the diameter of a circle, which is called pi in mathematical terms. It's about 3.14. So here they're using the approximation of 30 over 10, which is about 3, which is a common approximation. So, sorry, I just thought I had to mention that. If you, you know, these are, the Bible often uses round numbers. If it were actually some diameter of 10, then it would be about 31 and a half cubits around, about 30. But this is just a round number, which is used here. And so the description continues on with the details, like the lavers, the tables, and so forth. And I'm just skipping through some of this. Verse 19, Solomon had all the furnishings made for the house of God, the altar of gold and the tables in which was the showbread, the lampstands with their lamps of pure gold, to burn in the prescribed manner in front of the inner sanctuary. And it goes on. Yeah. Now, I'd like to think a little bit about the significance of this. And there's a tantalizing statement in the book of Hebrews, which always still gives me some justification for saying I don't have time to cover all the details. But Hebrews 9:5, the writer says, he's described a lot of these things that were in the tabernacle with overlap to the temple. And he says, after all of this, he makes this tantalizing statement, of these things we cannot now speak in detail. And, of course, his main point is to show how Christ is the fulfillment of all of that, but he doesn't give the details of it. People have written entire books about how the rich symbolism in the Old Testament ceremonial system points forward to Christ and many of the details. And I'd like to look at just a couple of examples of that. It's helpful to remember what a rich and outwardly glorious display their worship was. I mean, they had obviously a lot of gold. It was a beautiful place to look at. But they also had, they appealed to the other senses there. There was the burning of the sacrifice. There was the burning of incense, which I'd like to look at. In fact, one writer said that of all the senses that were appealed to, it was probably, you know, the nose, the sense of smell, that it was most, would most sense the richness of the worship. Besides, as we've already seen, the richness of the musical instruments that were added and all of that. So it was a very great and outward show of glory. And it's, I think, been a striking contrast when you come to the New Testament that's gone. That there's no outward glory in the same way. And of course, the point is that we have the fulfillment of what those things were pointing forward to. So all the richness and the outward pomp were pointing forward to the great high priest, who is Christ, and the glorious redemption that we have realized in clearer terms than they have. And that's why the book of Hebrews is, of course, so important, because he says again and again, don't go back. Don't think that's a greater, more glorious form of worship. Christ is greater than the angels, chapter 1. Christ is greater than Moses, in the chapters that follow. Don't think you've turned back to something better. You have something more more wonderful. As we saw in chapter 12, he says, you know, you haven't come into to a mountain that thunders and so forth, but you've come into the very presence of God. And when we worship, we enter then into the assembly of God through Christ. And that's the emphasis in the New Testament. And why it would be a mistake then to look back to the glory of the Old Testament and say those were the days, you know, when they had this incense rising and all this great grandeur. No, these are the days. This is the day in which Christ has come. And there's a statement which one of the reformers, a Swiss reformer, made that brings this out well, using a picture of a candle that I thought I would read. It says, the Old Testament ceremonies were like the lighting of candles, which in the hours before dawn served their own purpose. So he's like saying, you know, you're outside and you want to see what's going on before dawn, so you light these candles so you can see what's going on. That's what the Old Testament ceremonies were like. But after the sun has risen in the morning and ascended to the height of its noonday position, it is a strange lack of appreciation for the sunshine when we continue to burn candles. And that's the emphasis, which of course was so prominent in the Reformation, as they saw the Roman Catholic churches seeking to go back to the outward light of glory. He's saying it's really an insult to Christ. The full light has come. Why should you try to burn these candles anymore? That doesn't make any sense. Candles in the metaphorical sense. Well, the burning of candles was also an issue. After electricity. Let's look at some then of how that Old Testament richness is fulfilled in Christ. And the first thing I'd like to look at is the incense that I've already mentioned. So I'd like to turn to Psalm 141, verse 2. Bruce Wilkinson and I were talking about this during the past week, and he said that he was thinking of the elements of the Old Testament system as being metaphors for what we have in Christ. And you can see, this is literally a metaphor, or a simile, I guess, in Psalm 141, verse 2. The burning of the incense had a significance, and the significance wasn't lost even in the Old Testament. I'll read verse 1. Psalm 141, Psalm of David. Lord, I cry out to you, make haste to me. Give ear to my voice when I cry out to you. Let my prayer be set before you as incense, the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice. So there's the basic point that the incense that was to be burning before God was a picture of the prayers of his people. Now it's actually, like the temple itself, a complex metaphor. So we'll see it's not simply that incense stands for prayers, but there are rich associations with it. But already here in the psalm, David is saying, when I see the incense rising, and it was apparently rich enough that even those who were outside where it was burning could see it. When I see the incense rising, then I will be spurred to pray. And let my prayer rise before you and be sweet before you. I think that's the implication. God on us, even as the incense is so rising before you. And then he connects it, interestingly enough, the lifting up of my hands with the evening sacrifice. So the incense was actually burned morning and evening, just as there are morning and evening sacrifices. And the connection between the two, between the burning of the incense and the evening sacrifice, is closer than I had thought before I started studying this. You can get Nave's Topical Bible or something like that. Just look up incense and you'll see lots of interesting references. But one that struck me in particular is in the book of Leviticus, chapter 16, verse 13. Now, of course, you should be warned that when people start talking about these things, they can go off into all sorts of weird ideas. I'm trying not to go off into all kinds of weird ideas, but stick to what's relatively plain scriptural evidence. But the incense didn't just have, it wasn't simply prayer disconnected from the sacrifice. But this is now a rather special circumstance. It has to do with the atonement and the holy place itself, and not the regular burning of incense. But I'll start with Leviticus 16:12. Then he, that is Aaron, be the high priest in general, shall take a censer full of burning coals of fire from the altar before the Lord, with his hands full of sweet incense, beaten fine, and bring it inside the veil. He shall put the incense on the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of incense may cover the mercy seat that is on the testimony, lest he die. Now this is a fact which Aaron would not want to forget. The emphasis here is the fact that somehow the incense provides a covering from the judgment that would come on man because of his sin. And that idea could be developed further it's called the altar of incense, even though there was no offering on it, but the coals that were used to burn the sacrifice were also used to fire the incense. And there's a very rich connection between the two that's made, that the incense is so closely connected with the offering of sacrifice that in it, then in the New Testament, it becomes a picture that not only do we pray before God, the incense is our prayers, but our prayers are made acceptable by the offering of Christ. And I think we'll see that in some of the New Testament references. I'll skip over some of the other references. I encourage you at some point to look at Luke chapter 1, where Zacharias, remember, when he gets the news from the angel that he and his wife will have a child. That's while he's offering the incense, and there's an emphasis there that all the people are praying. There's apparently a connection even known then between the incense rising and the prayer being made. And of course the angel says, "Your prayers are heard," while he's standing next to the altar of incense. So that's an interesting passage to look at. But I'd like to look at the book of Revelation, chapter 5, verse 8. If you get too nervous, we're not going to be trying to figure out everything in the book of Revelation. There are some things that are plainer than others, and the richness of the Old Testament system is used in the book of Revelation to point to Christ. And so when in the book of Revelation you see all of the use of the Old Testament system, you shouldn't think, oh, well, you know, we're going to go back to that at some point because it's in the book of Revelation. Well, that would be to miss the point. The Old Testament system was a picture of the worship in heaven. And the writer of Hebrews makes that point. And so he continues the symbolism in this verse, in these verses. Revelation chapter 5, remember John had wept because no one was able to open the scroll, and then he was pointed to the lion of Judah, who turned out to be a lamb, and was worthy to open the scroll. And the lamb has taken the scroll in verse 7. And now verse 8 of Revelation 5. Now when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each having a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. So there again is the connection that the incense was a representation of the prayers of the saints. And they then go on to praise the Lamb, to praise the one sitting on the throne of the Lamb, for the redemption which is brought about. I'd like to look at one other reference in Revelation, which I'll look at a little bit more detail. Revelation chapter 8, well, let me start at verse 1 because I think it gives the context. I'm not going to talk about what the trumpets mean and all this, all right? But the seventh seal in this case. But this passage is, I think, a helpful one for understanding the significance of the Old Testament picture. When he opened the seventh seal, Revelation 8:1, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. And I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. But then another angel, having a golden censer, came and stood at the altar. He was given much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar, which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense, with the prayers of the saints, ascended before God from the angel's hand. Then the angel took the censer, filled it with fire from the altar, and threw it to the earth. And there were noises, thunderings, lightnings, and an earthquake. Now there seems to be a connection at the end of what I read, the judgment that was to come, with the prayers, because they're an appeal for God's justice to be shown. But what I'd like to point out especially is the fact, again, that the incense is connected with the prayers. Although he seems to be treating them as two separate issues, two separate things, it's not uncommon in the book of Revelation to mention the thing and its fulfillment or its representation together. So I don't really think he's saying that the incense and the prayers are something separate. But the fact that these are brought, that these are offered upon the golden altar which was before the throne, I think is again a reminder of the fact that it's because of Christ's intercession that our prayers are heard. And the connection between the incense and the offering in the Old Testament, I think, carries over to the fact that our prayers are acceptable to God and they're a sweet savor only because of Christ and only because of His prayers. So ultimately, you could say the incense really represents Christ's prayers on our behalf, although in Him we also offer our petitions. This is a very rich imagery, and I think it's one worth thinking on, even in your own prayers, to think of the fact that just as in the Old Testament there is the rising up of the incense and the sweetness of it before God, so our prayers are made acceptable to God, but only in so much as we are shielded from the wrath of God through Christ. And I thought I would read a little bit from a commentary on Revelation by James Durham. He actually interprets the angel in verse 3 who offers up the prayers as Christ himself. Whether you accept that or not doesn't really matter for what he says. But what he says is rich enough that I thought I would be part of it. He says, Christ offereth and perfumeth all the saints' prayers, less or more. That is, whether you're a great person or prayers are great or not. There's no prayer in any saint that he refuses, whether they be weak or strong, whether they be faint or more fervent, less or more spirit and life, whether shorter or longer, well-ordered or confused. They come from saints, of course it means Christians, to be warranted in the word and grounded upon the promise and put up in his name. They are by him offered. All go in one censer, and all go up as the smoke of sweet incense, and through him are accepted of God. He taketh the least sigh and putteth it in his censer, and it hath a good favor to God out of his hand. He refuseth no saint's prayer, nor sendeth it back unanswered. And then later on he says, it is a matter of consolation in and after prayer, and ground of quietness, that however our prayers be not much worth, means in themselves, yet Christ's incense makes them savory. This being well considered would teach us to make more confidence in praying than anxiously to dispute whether we be heard or no. So there's a lot more. It's very, very, I think, encouraging statement that he makes to think about our prayers in those terms as being sweetened through the sacrifice of Christ. I'd like to look at one other image, that is that of the pillar, also in Revelation. But let me pause and see if you have comments or questions.
Looking around, old people probably have a little bit of a positive thing.
Of course, the danger is that then it tends to make one feel holy, whether one is feeling holy or not. And that's part of the criticism that is lodged. It's accompanied by. Yeah. There's a whole ritual associated. It's also burning because of killing jerks too. You have some story about putting too much in words. We'll have to talk about that later. Dave's pranked. Well, let's go on to the pillar. We'll talk about knocking down pillars. There were two pillars, remember, the apparently ornamental type pillars, although that doesn't really matter for this discussion. And there's a reference in the book of Revelation to that idea, if not specifically to those pillars. Turn to Revelation 3. 3:12. Now, I tried to build the case before that the New Testament fulfillment of the Old Testament building of the temple is the people of God. That the people of God, especially gathered to his worship, are the temple of God. And there are plenty of references to that. We saw that at the end of the book of Revelation, God comes to dwell with his people in the full way, so that it said there is no temple, because God himself is the land of the temple. But in Revelation 3:12, there's something of that same idea. The promise is given here, I think, to those who are suffering persecution and difficulty, but could be applied more widely. Christ says in Revelation 3:12, "He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I will write on him my new name." Now, I'm not sure whether the writing of the name is connected with the pillar the way it was in the Old Testament. I'm not trying to press the details here. But the fact that he has the promise given that he will be a pillar in the temple of God, and especially the significance of the fact that they will no longer be suffering this persecution and displaced to the place where they would like to be. So it says here, verse 12, "He shall go out no more." And that's the richness of the promise, is the permanency of the fellowship that we have with God for eternity, that we have some taste of even now. That's why the people of God can be said to be the fulfillment of the temple. Yet the ultimate promise is that in the end you'll be fixed, as it were, in God's presence. You won't ever be displaced from for eternity you'll enjoy that fellowship with God. And that idea is something that even comes up in a very rich way in the Psalms. Psalm 27, for example, the psalmist says, you know, "How I would love just to be able to stay in your presence, O God, to be able to dwell in your temple," and it comes up elsewhere. So this is, I think, an allusion that you will be a pillar in the temple, the promise of dwelling in God's presence, which later Psalm, you know, says, "If I could only do like the sparrows, you know, got to build their nest there, that's what I would like to do." Now that's something, as I said, that we can enjoy even now, but this is a promise which looks forward to complete new heaven. Well, those are some, so I didn't look at none of the symbolism. I looked at two examples of it, some of the richness that can be drawn out from the details of the building of God's temple. I'd like to conclude just by making a few comments on 2 Chronicles chapter 5. So let's go back to 2 Chronicles. At the conclusion of the building of the temple, there's a long section in Chronicles, and also it's fairly lengthy in Kings, which describes the dedication of the temple. And there's a familiar, very long prayer of Solomon, which Lord willing we'll get to in a meeting next week here, but 2 weeks on. And I'd like just to set the stage for that a little bit by looking at some of the things in 2 Chronicles chapter 5. It says in verse 1, "So all the work that Solomon had done for the house of the Lord was finished." And finishing then leads in verse 2 to the statement, "Now Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the chief fathers of the children of Israel, in Jerusalem, that they might bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord up from the city of David, which is Zion." Remember where we are with the Ark. It's already been moved once, and it's in the city of David. David had it moved up where it had been. And now it will be moved officially into the temple of Solomon. "Therefore all the men of Israel assembled with the king at the feast, which was in the seventh month." In a footnote, that would be the Feast of Tabernacles. So this was in conjunction with the Feast of Tabernacles that his dedication took place. "So all the elders of Israel came, and the Levites took up the ark." And there's a description then in the verses that follow it, the offering of sacrifices. In verse 6, so many that they couldn't be counted. Solomon knew how to do it. I mean, he was a lot of wealth, and he was very generous in the use of that. And it describes in the verses that follow the bringing of the ark to the most holy place, the wings of the cherubim touching, and so forth. Let me skip down to verse 11. "And it came to pass when the priests came out of the most holy place, for all the priests who were present had sanctified themselves without keeping to their divisions. And the Levites, who were the singers, all those of Asaph and Heman and Jeduthun, their sons and their brethren, stood at the east end of the altar, clothed in white linen, having cymbals, stringed instruments, and harps, and with them 120 priests sounding with trumpets. Indeed, it came to pass, when the trumpeters and singers were as one, to make one sound to be heard in praising and thanking the Lord. And when they lifted up their voice with the trumpets and cymbals and instruments of music and praised the Lord, saying, "For he is good, for his mercy endures forever," that the house of the Lord was filled with a cloud, so that the priests could not continue ministering because of the cloud. The glory of the Lord filled the house of God. Now there is the greatness of the glory of the temple in action, and the blessing that God showed by his presence at the end there, filling it with the cloud, is something which you may remember happened earlier in the history of Israel, the reference in Exodus 40. At the end of the book of Exodus, there's the same overwhelming presence of God. And I'd like just to point out a few things. We noticed before these guys, Asaph and Heman and Jeduthun, they were set apart to compose the music called prophets, wrote prophetic music for the worship of God, which of course had come to us in the book of Psalms. The references to their, like in the end of verse 11, not keeping to their divisions, having to do with the priests, and also with the number of those later on, they had set up a schedule, so some would minister at some time and some would minister at the others, but this was a grand occasion, so they were all there. And all of Israel was there, as we saw earlier, at least by the representatives. This is a great time of assembling to worship God. And I'd like to point out again the emphasis on the joyfulness of this. The chronicler goes through and emphasizes again and again that they did it all according to the word of the Lord. You shouldn't think that they were doing it in a perfunctory way, like they got out the rule book and said, "Okay, well, today we do this." And it was a great time of rejoicing, and you can sense that even without explicit statements here, and later on I think we'll see more explicit statements. This was a time of great excitement and joy because of what God was doing. The verse that's cited here that they sang at the end of verse 13, "For he is good and his mercy endures forever," should sound familiar to you. That phrase occurs in many of the Psalms. I put up here, it's more or less exactly Psalm 136, verse 1, except for a reference to Israel, which we'll look later. But I put up some of the other Psalms where this idea occurs. They praise God, "For he is good, for his mercy endures forever." And that phrase, in fact, comes up not only many times in the Psalms, but many times in the book of Chronicles, where it says they sang. This is the sort of the typical thing that they sang. It was one of their favorite songs, you might say, or a favorite phrase in the songs. And it's appropriate, of course. We praise God because he is good, because his mercy endures forever. As we noted last time, the mercy, that word mercy, is God's covenant faithfulness. It's used in those terms throughout the Old Testament to talk about the fact that God is certainly merciful toward all in some sense. Yeah. The word mercy has a special emphasis on his keeping his covenant of love with his people. So his loving kindness endures forever toward his people especially. And that's, of course, appropriate on this occasion as the Ark of the Covenant is brought in connection with the Mosaic Covenant. So there should be an emphasis on God's covenant-keeping faithfulness. Any comments or questions? Glorious and evidence.